I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is with a father who's suing the Veterans Administration, saying if they'd better understood his son's post-traumatic stress, they might have been able to prevent his son's suicide. But first, some new statistics from the Army today on active duty suicide. The full report will be released later today. It shows that suicides continue to rise from 67 in 2004 to 108 last year, up from 102 the year before. And that's just active troops, not veterans and veterans and others, and just soldiers, not Marines or other branches of the military. Well, the rise in numbers comes after a complete review of the Army's suicide prevention program was ordered last year. The Army website produced a suicide prevention guide that was posted, and it says, since the beginning of the global war on terror, the Army has lost over 580 soldiers to suicide, the equivalent of the entire infantry battalion task force. Brian Bender is with the Boston Globe. Brian, give us some background here. What more is this report going to say?
Basically, the Army is going to report to Congress in a report later today that suicides last year in the, again, active duty Army were 108, and that is the highest in two decades, basically, and it's just another sign of what we've seen in the last few years of this rising stress on men and women in uniform who are being deployed repeatedly.
And more than 40% of these suicides came after soldiers returned home from these deployments. Also this week, for the first time ever, the Pentagon released some statistics on post-traumatic stress disorder. They say the number of troops diagnosed with PTSD jumped more than 46% last year, over 38,000 cases over the past 5 years. Now, we're going to be hearing in a moment from a father making the connection between PTSD and suicide. But I'm wondering, are others drawing, you know, the dotted line between yesterday's report on the spike in PTSD and today's on a spike in suicides?
Well, you know, I think clearly everyone would agree that since both are up quite dramatically, there must be a connection.
Well, and as we said, these are just active troops. Let's address veterans for just a second. We know that in December, parents of Iraq War veterans who had committed suicide also attended hearings on the Hill before the House Veterans Affairs Committee. They were asking for more comprehensive tracking of suicide numbers. How are suicides counted?
Well, you know, I think one of the things we're learning is that some of these statistics are not very well tracked by the military, which is why Congress has demanded more information. You know, certainly the men and women who are still in uniform are having problems. That's something they obviously track pretty closely. What we're starting to learn is that those who've been discharged after, you know, a couple of deployments to Iraq or Afghanistan are sort of going into the veterans' health system, and perhaps the transition there is not very good, and they're not getting the kind of care that they need. And, you know, if they're not going in to get some help, then it's going to be hard for the government to keep track of sort of how many men and women out there who've just gotten out of the military are having similar problems.
Well, today's suicide report from the Army comes after two very controversial emails were leaked about veterans care. In one, Ira Katz, the top doctor at the head of the VA's mental health division, wrote, and this is in February, that the VA was identifying 1,000 suicide attempts a month. Again, these are veterans, not active duty. In his email, Katz wrote to his staff, shh, literally the word shh, S-H-H-H, and then, is this something we should carefully address ourselves in some sort of release before someone stumbles on it? Leading a lot of critics to say the military has been trying to cover up the number of suicides.
Right. Well, I mean, clearly those emails suggest that, you know, this information has been out there. At least the folks in the military or physicians who are treating troops have known this, but it obviously has not been reported up the chain, or if it has been, they certainly haven't been talking about it.
The other email was reported earlier this month that in March, a VA psychologist wrote to the staff at a hospital in Temple, Texas, a VA hospital, writing, given that we are having more compensation-seeking veterans, I'd like to suggest you refrain from giving a diagnosis of PTSD straight out. Do you think there's going to be, that Congress will be looking more into the reporting and tracking of both PTSD and suicides?
I think there's no doubt. Now that the Pentagon has put together some more up-to-date figures and, you know, some worrisome figures, I think Congress is going to want to take a closer look at this to see, one, if the military has enough people to treat soldiers that may be having problems when they're coming back from deployment. And, you know, and taking a deeper look, I guess, also into maybe some ways these things can be prevented.
Brian Bender covers the Pentagon for the Boston Globe. Brian, thanks so much.
Sure.
Well, according to a recent Congressional Research Service report, the true incidence of suicides among veterans is not known. But based on numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the VA estimates it's 18 veterans a day, although that's veterans from all wars. Kevin Lucy of Belchertown, Massachusetts, says the Veterans Administration is not doing enough to prevent those suicides. He's suing the VA for the wrongful death of his son, Jeffrey. Kevin, welcome. And we are, first of all, so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Well, it's a difficult story to tell, but it's one you want to tell. So let's do that. It seems as if things spiraled out of control for Jeffrey. Within the year after he came back from Iraq, how so? How did you see this?
Well, initially it was very deceptive. He looked fantastic physically when he came back, and he had no physical wounds. But the hidden wounds didn't manifest itself until approximately, for the first time really, about 6 months after. It was Christmas Eve. We went over to the grandparents, as we always do, and Jeff, for the first time ever, asked us whether he could stay home. His sister came back later that evening and found him crying in the kitchen, and he had been drinking, so he was drunk. And he took off dog tags that he had worn, and he threw them at his sister, saying he was nothing more than a murderer. Yeah. But then the very next day, Jeff was fine. Then in mid-March of 2004, Jeff really exploded. All the symptomology just exploded, and he spiraled downward.
What were the symptoms? What was he doing?
Well, ever since he had been back, he had been vomiting every single day in the early morning. But then, as time went on, he became very nervous. He became highly anxious. He was going to school, and he was developing an isolating type of behavior. Yeah. And he was drinking.
We also understand when he went to Holyoke Community College, he would, you know, if there was a noise, that classic reaction, he'd duck. He had that sort of, nervous anxiety and reaction.
Right. And then what happened is that he started experiencing hallucinations. And not only visual hallucinations, but audio and tactile. At night, we found, Joyce, his mom, found a flashlight he would keep under his bed because he could hear camel spiders crawling all over his room.
Camel spiders? These are the big spiders from Iraq?
Very big. They're about 5 inches. And Jeffy, ever since he had been a small boy, he was always terrified of spiders.
Yeah.
So all this started happening, and it started, his world started falling apart. The PTSD affected his relationships because you will hear every now and then the Army try to say, well, they killed themselves because of a failed relationship. Well, Jeffy's and Julie's was failing, but it was because of the PTSD. So when we hear that type of excuse being used by the Army, it's infuriating. But what happened is that Jeff was starting to talk about suicide with other people, and then we found out, so we tried to get him into therapy. Now, the soldiers are terrified to admit that they have the problem because they get stigmatized. That stigma, we think, is tremendously fatal to a lot of our young men and women.
Well, still, you did take him to the Northampton VA Medical Center out in western Massachusetts. He did get private counseling. A private therapist diagnosed him with PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where did things, you know, go wrong, at least as far as the VA, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, we brought Jeff there on May 28th, 2004. He was there for the Memorial Day weekend. He was seen by a psychiatrist on May 28th that evening, but he was never seen again by a psychiatrist until the day of discharge. That was on June 1st, and during that period of time, Jeff said that he felt that he was just warehoused. And then what happened was we found out in the records after Jeff died, we went up there and got the records, and all of a sudden we found out that he had told them 3 different ways he planned to kill himself: overdose, hanging, suffocation. And, of course, he did hang. And Not only that, he also shared with them that he had bought a hose. But none of this was ever shared with the family.
Well, it sounds as if, in this horrific experience that you had with your son, there are two things going on now, because you had a private therapist who diagnosed Jeff with PTSD.
Correct.
But did the VA?
No.
What did they say?
They said that Jeff would have to maintain a period of sobriety, 2 to 3 months, before they would even begin to assess him for PTSD, which flies in the very knowledge that most therapists have today. You do dual diagnostic approach. You don't do that type of approach.
Well, we should say a hospital spokesperson at the VA in Northampton wouldn't comment on your lawsuit, but she did say no one is denied admission because of substance abuse, and they are now trying to treat both substance abuse and PTSD concurrently because of new research. At the time, we read in reports they felt that treatment for PTSD would conflict with, you know, the medicine might conflict with treatment for alcoholism.
But I do know that had they created a very different type of treatment milieu, so for example, Jeff was put up into a locked ward with much older veterans who were schizophrenic, who were suffering from dementia. You have a young man who is suffering himself, and you put him in a treatment environment like that. Is it any wonder that Jeff refused to go back there? The VA should have been prepared to accept all these people. If they didn't have other Iraqi veterans, he should have been transferred to a facility that had other Iraqi veterans. Mm-hmm. Jeff was one of the first ones to ever go into the floor. Even though this was 2004, we were in the war for over a year, the healthcare system for veterans never prepared itself.
This unit in Springfield, the Northampton unit, was one of four, only four, across the country. And I'm wondering, what do you think about what we're learning about more of the culture of attitude toward suicide in the military? We have two reports, the email that I mentioned that was written by a top doctor in the VA saying, shh, you know, keep this quiet. But I'm hearing we have about 1,000 suicide attempts per month among the veterans we see in our medical facilities. Is this something we should carefully address in some sort of release before someone stumbles on it? And then there was also the email that was reported recently that was sent to a staff at a VA hospital in Texas by a psychologist who wrote, given that we're having more and more compensation-seeking veterans, I'd like to suggest you refrain from giving a diagnosis of PTSD straight out.
And these are the same people, Robin, who say that they support our troops. They don't support our troops. And I'll be honest with you, with Dr. Katz, I felt that, and I know this is strong, but I really did feel that he spit on our son's grave.
And again, Dr. Katz is the doctor who wrote the email saying shush about suicide statistics. That's Kevin Lucey. His son Jeffrey, a Marine who served in Iraq, hung himself a year after he came home. When we come back, what does Kevin think the solutions are for preventing this, keeping it from happening again? Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from Kevin Lucey, whose son Jeffrey, a Marine who served during the invasion of Iraq, committed suicide in 2004 after he came home. Kevin is now suing the Veterans Administration for not properly diagnosing and treating his son's post-traumatic stress disorder. And Kevin, we have come to the most difficult part. You know, as you said, your son was spiraling. The VA wouldn't treat him until he got sober. He didn't want to get alcohol treatment. You've given us hints. You said your son had bought a hose and that he hung himself. Kevin, you found him. So only as much as you want. Tell us what happened.
Well, the night before Jeff died, it was a very bad night. I came home, and he was in total rage. He hated the government. He hated the oil. He hated the war. And I had to call the vet center, and an angel answered us because she really got me to calm down and then spoke to Jeff for a period of time. And Jeff was in a much better place. But about 11:30 that night, for the second time ever, with the first time being about 10 days before he, and with his sister present, Jeffrey asked me if he could sit in my lap and if we could rock. And I rocked him in silence for about 45 minutes. And And then he walked over to his bedroom. He wasn't sleeping now. We hugged, and I stayed up until about 2 o'clock. But then the next day when I came home, I held Jeff in my lap for the very last time as I buttressed his body up and got the hose from around his neck. And he was dead. I lowered his body to the ground, and I tried to make a pillow. Jeff, for the first time in over 4 months, he actually did look peaceful. He was able to achieve what no one would give him, what our government turned their back to him. He was able to achieve himself. But what a cost.
What do you want to have happen?
We want the VA and this government to start treating our troops with the dignity and the honor that they deserve. We want the VA to be woken up from being the slumbering giant. We want them to start changing. We want them to start going out. We want them to start developing the resources to be able to say, if you are feeling this bad, here, come to us. We'll care for you. Right now, that, as you can see by the emails, that is not the culture.
Well, the Veterans Administration says it's instituted a suicide prevention hotline. Back in November, the president signed the Joshua Omvig Suicide Prevention Bill. This is named after an Iowa reservist who killed himself in front of his mother.
Right. Randy and Ellen. Oh.
Yeah, you know them. It directs the VA to improve mental health training. Is this a start?
It is. It is a start, and I applaud them. But there's so much more to do. What happens with the suicide hotline if all of a sudden they're starting to recognize all these suicide attempts? Where are you going to place them? Nobody cared enough to develop the resources in regional areas to treat our men and women.
Kevin, you know, devil's advocate here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to people who say suicide is horrible? A percentage of the population commits suicide.
My response to them is military PTSD, I believe, is very different from PTSD from a lot of other sources because the military preconditions the soldiers not to want to seek help. Because if you seek help, you're weak. And if you're weak, then you aren't being strong for your comrades in the unit. Jeff said it, I think, perfectly on June 14th. He was sitting in front of our fireplace. He was crying, and he was going down a list of symptoms in a book that I had just purchased on PTSD. And he was saying, I have this, I have this, I have this. And then he looked up at us with tears in his eyes, and he said, you know, I think I'm going crazy. I know in my mind that all these feelings I'm having is horrible, but they aren't real. But you see, the thing is, there's a huge disconnect between the intellect and his feelings. And that's what I think causes a lot of the problems when it comes to PTSD, and people don't know where to go.
Well, you know, it's funny. You talk about your son reacting before he died, of course, to a book that you'd taken out on PTSD and looking up from reading the symptoms. I thought you might also be saying, why isn't every troop given that list so that this is something
exactly.
They prepare for?
And why doesn't all the families know about this? I'll be honest with you, Robin, when Jeff was going through his most tormented hell, we, as a family, had our own form of PTSD. We felt powerless. We felt hopeless when the VA would not take Jeff back in and Jeff wouldn't go back in voluntarily. We felt abandoned. All of a sudden, our family started isolating itself. Then we had sleep deprivation because when Jeff wasn't sleeping, we couldn't sleep. All the chaos, all the rage became our routine. To be honest with you, until the day I put my arms around my son. I never really thought how lethal PTSD could be.
Kevin, I cannot thank you enough for talking to us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Believe me, we thank you for your interest.
And again, Kevin Lucey is suing the Veterans Administration for the wrongful death of his son Jeffrey, a Marine who committed suicide. We asked the VA for a written statement in response to our interview. They couldn't comment on Kevin Lucey's lawsuit because it is still pending. But the VA did say it wants every veteran struggling with mental health problems to come to the VA, that every VA medical center has a suicide coordinator. And the VA mentioned its latest effort, which is to call each and every Iraq and Afghanistan veteran to make them aware of their eligibility for care. Well, still ahead, rebuilding in a tornado-ravaged Iowa town. That's after the news, here and now. Nearly one out of every three children in the world has never had his or her birth registered. Now, that may seem like a small thing, but without a birth certificate, a child is essentially stateless and can't claim any of the rights or protections afforded citizens of a modern nation state. That becomes especially a problem when children become refugees. And the problem isn't limited to developing nations. Children of illegal immigrants who can't prove their age or nationality in the U.S. and Europe also face problems. Dr. Jacqueline Baba is the director of the Harvard University Committee on Human Rights. She recently moderated a conference on children without a state. Doctor, let's start with children who are stateless because they are refugees. What kind of documents do they get?
So it depends on the citizenship laws of the country you're born in. So say, for argument's sake, there was a refugee camp in the U.S., you would still become an American citizen because any child born in the U.S. becomes American. You may also become a citizen because your parents' nationality passes to you by descent. But just being a citizen doesn't mean that you get a birth certificate. And that's where the real problem occurs, that many of these births aren't recorded. So you've got nothing to prove your age. You've got nothing to prove your identity. So in some situations, this can be a very serious problem. In some cases, any child in a camp will be vaccinated. Any child in a camp will get a certain quota of provisions. But in other situations, that may not be the case. And particularly where there's contestation or conflict, this could be very serious.
Well, and that's what we wanted to ask you. I mean, it sounds as if there are huge problems that would come for a child who is stateless. On the other hand, if you are from Darfur and in a refugee camp and stateless, because of being uprooted, how much is documentation going to protect you from being killed by the Janjaweed? Or, how does it protect a child who is in that terrible situation?
Documents do, of course, not solve all the problems, but they are very important, necessary conditions, I would say, for improving the situation. So say you're a child in a refugee camp in Chad who's fled from Darfur, and say there's a possibility of resettlement via the offices of the United Nations, and, refugees do get resettled. Now, if you're, say, eligible for that and you have no documents, you're going to be disqualified. It's going to put you in a much worse position than if you had a document. So, of course, having a birth certificate doesn't protect you from the Janjaweed. It doesn't protect you from an insurgency. It doesn't protect you necessarily from being recruited as a child soldier. But not having a birth certificate can prevent you from getting protections you need.
There's so many problems that having documentation solves for kids. They can get health care. They can go to school, get vaccinated, all those things that happen for children. But I'm wondering, too, how much would documentation of children, making sure children aren't stateless, help with the global problem of child slavery, child abduction? Where does this play out there?
I think documentation plays quite an important part. For example, take abduction. If you don't have a record of somebody's existence, then the possibility that they will be abducted and never traced is much greater. Let me give you an example. During the Civil War, in the Civil Wars in Latin American countries, there were many cases where children were forcibly separated from their parents by the military forces, and then they were put in orphanages or they were given up for adoption, and their births were never properly recorded. And now, Physicians for Human Rights and other organizations are still trying to track some of those children who were given up for adoption when they actually had families. Now, if those children had had proper birth certificates and there had been a proper register of their birth, it would have been much easier to track them than it is in situations where they don't have the relevant documents. So that sort of thing can actually make a difference, and which is why the United Nations recognize that having a legal identity is one of the most important human rights protections, because it's a basic starting point that you exist as a person in law. It doesn't mean that you're going to have a good life. It doesn't mean that you're not going to be abused. It doesn't mean that you're not going to be perhaps made to be a child worker. But it does mean that you have some mechanism at least for tracing where you are.
What about people who don't want to be recognized by law, who don't want to be known? You studied the Roma, the gypsies, who live in Italy, and recently an immigration crackdown left hundreds fleeing for their lives. Local citizens burned down a neighborhood after rumors. I mean, just a really ugly news story. But the fact is that the Roma want to be isolated and don't want to be registered.
I think I disagree with you there, Robin. I don't think that the Roma want to be isolated and don't want to be registered. I think the Roma have been targets of extraordinary discrimination and exclusion over centuries. And I think the situation that you refer to in Italy is just the culmination of years of segregation and discrimination. So if you take the situation of the camps that were burnt down, the so-called nomad camps outside Naples, the Roma were forced to live in those camps, not allowed to get jobs. So they're really in an impossible situation, and the Roma families are having an incredibly difficult time surviving. I think that this problem of exclusion is not something that the community have chosen. It's something that has been sort of inflicted on them.
Well, I'm informed because we think of the Roma as, you know, grifters in the United States,
yes.
People that don't want to have their identity known. In fact, they just assume someone else's.
And I think that many Italians would say that too. I think of it as very analogous to sort of the attitude to African Americans in the past, which is, oh, you know, they're lazy and they don't want to work. And, you know, problems of exclusion and discrimination get recast as problems of culture and problems of attitude. And, you know, only 3% of Romanian Roma children in Italy are in school. So there's 20,000 of these kids are not in school at all.
And you're not saying that's a choice?
I think it's complicated. I mean, I think that it's certainly not a choice of the children.
Right.
I think that, you know, the attitudes of the teachers, the attitudes of the government, the attitudes of the states are very, very harsh. And so it's not easy to keep your child in school.
It's more a consequence.
And yeah. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't some communities that may not choose to register the birth of their children. So in some minority communities where you have a persecuted minority, they may not want to go to a state office and register their child for fear of some form of retaliation.
And that's a problem for children.
Yeah, that's a serious problem.
Dr. Jacqueline Baba is the director of the Harvard University Committee on Human Rights, recently moderated a conference on children without a state, stateless children, and is behind a push to get them documented around the world. Dr. Baba, do you think this is going to happen?
I think that there is increasing awareness that the lack of birth registration and the growth of statelessness is a problem. I think it's very expensive to rectify, and I think it needs a lot of political will. But I think that as migration becomes more and more a fact of life, and as states have more and more of an impetus to regularize migration, to include populations and not exclude them, so I think they will invest resources in making it possible for communities that have so far been excluded to register their children and make it easier for them to have a legal identity.
Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Okay, let's look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, his new CD is being called one of the best this year. He sings Nouveau Outlaw Country. We'll visit with Hayes Carl. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Residents in Iowa continue to mourn the dead and find shelter for the living after a series of powerful tornadoes ripped through that state on Sunday. 6 people were killed, dozens injured, in what's already the deadliest tornado season in a decade. In the small agricultural town of Parkersburg in northeast Iowa, Half of all homes were destroyed or damaged. City Hall was demolished, along with the town's only gas station and grocery store. Well, joining us on his cell phone from the Parkersburg Fire Station is Mayor Robert Haylock. Mr. Mayor, first of all, thanks for the time, and how is everyone doing?
We're actually getting along just fine. Fortunately, it's raining today and makes the recovery and the cleanup a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. Well, you know, the pictures are always awful after an event like this, but they begin to look a little bit the same. You know, we see people picking through piles of debris. How can you explain to us how damaged your town is?
Well, it's just total devastation. To the southern third of the city, all you see is rubble where buildings used to stand.
This comes at a time when we know Parkersburg was poised to really soar because of the sale of corn for ethanol. We're understanding that these were good times in Parkersburg.
Yes, Parkersburg was a growing community. We had several new subdivisions being developed, people building houses, and now most of those are gone.
We know that the farmers had been buying new tractors and trucks for the first time in a long time. How does the farmland look?
I don't think it will have any major effect on the farming business. It certainly has had on residential areas.
How frightening is it to people there that two of the people who were killed in Parkersburg responded to the tornado sirens and warnings, and they were in their basements?
Well, I think it points out something that if you go into the basement, alone doesn't save your life. You need to go to a small room in the basement. What happened in some cases was the house fell in on top of the basement. You have more support if you have wall support in some of the smaller rooms.
So you have to go into like a furnace room or something where you're more enclosed.
Correct.
Four people died in Parkersburg. Do you think the system worked, though? I mean, or do you think there were flaws in the warning system?
The system worked tremendously well. It's just a miracle we only have lost four people. When a tornado is predicted, we send weather spotters out to the west side of town, and they watch for the tornado coming. And they did spot the tornado and radioed back, and then the sirens went off, and the people had plenty of notice to go to the basement or to go to a place of protection.
You know, the high school was nearly leveled, the football field, goalposts all twisted, bleachers broken, and this is a town that takes great pride in sending, what, four players to the NFL in just
five? There are five currently serving in the NFL, five graduates.
From one school?
From one small school.
Well, I know your football coach has said the school's team will play as soon as possible.
Yes. He is stressing to the kids that they will be playing football on that field this fall.
And what are your, as mayor, what are your biggest challenges now?
It's hard to specifically pick out one. There are so many. We're currently opening a new city hall because that was totally destroyed.
Yeah, we understand you had records back to the 1800s that are gone.
Yes. So we're currently working on getting that open so that citizens have another location to get information. We have a tremendous staff from all over the United States centered here at the fire station, trying to coordinate all of the efforts, and they're doing a very good job.
A small town under 2,000 people, but 21 businesses and 200 homes lost. Where do those hundreds of people go?
Most of them are staying with friends and relatives and coming back in during the day and working around the house or finding some of their personal possessions sifting through the rubble.
I'm imagining you're coming across a lot of, you know, a lot of heartbreak.
Yes, but I also am amazed at the stamina of the people. I mean, you talk to them and they've lost everything. And basically, their comment is, we're still alive. We can always build a house.
That's Parkersburg, Iowa, Mayor Robert Haylock at the fire station, one of the remaining buildings there in Parkersburg after last Sunday's tornado. Mr. Mayor, best to you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get ready to be further uplifted. In just 1 minute, we'll have the Cuban Miami sound of Tiempo Libre. That's coming up here and now. Cuba, under its new leader, Raul Castro, brother of Fidel, has launched a series of economic reforms, including lifting the bans on Cubans using tourist hotels, making more household appliances available to them, and letting Cubans have cell phones. Well, now there'll be more people for them to talk to. This month, President Bush announced that despite the over four-decade-long embargo against Cuba, Americans will be allowed to send cell phones to family members in Cuba. Of course, Cuba and the U.S. have long been connected through music. That's the Cuban-born, Miami-based band Tiempo Libre. The group formed in 2001 with a mission to spread their blend of Cuban sound with an American flavor, and it's been working. Tiempo Libre has twice been nominated for Grammy Awards, including a nod for their latest album, Lo Que Esperabas, or What You've Been Waiting For. That's the title track from What You've Been Waiting For, which Tiempo Libre's musical director and keyboard player Jorge Gomez told us is what fans say. They've been waiting to hear Tiempo Libre's timba sound.
Our goal is to teach everybody in the United States it's not only a music, it's a way to life.
Tell us more about timba, and is it son, this sound of yours? It's described as a combination of both. So what's timba, this sound that your fans have been waiting to hear?
Well, basically, timba is the mix between jazz and son from Cuba. If you put Buena Vista Social Club and Chick Corea together, you have timba.
Buena Vista Club and Chick Corea together gets timba. That's great.
Yes.
And son, what is son?
It's a very low rhythm. You have to have a very good singer. And they follow pattern.
Can you sort of like, you know, give us a sense of the... Well, and we also have it recorded in your Arroz con Mango, Rice with Mango. Let's listen to that. It's the title track of your first album. There's that beat.
Tenía solo tres años cuando mis padres se fueron de Cuba, mi tierra linda, como decían mis abuelos. Con el pasar de los años mi cabeza se volvía loca, en la escuela hablando inglés, pero al llegar a mi casa.
Tell us about the lyrics in this song, Rice with Mango. What are we hearing here?
An immigrant who left his country, in this case Cuba. And he feel a little confused here in the United States because they don't eat the same food, they don't treat the people like they used to do in Cuba. But at the end of the song we say, well, no matter what happened, no matter where you live, you are Cuban by birth.
Cuban by birth. You wrote this music with Fernando Pena, who wrote the lyrics. Tell us a little bit about your story. When did you leave Cuba and how did you leave?
Well, I left Cuba when I was 25 years. I went to Guatemala. I lived there for 5 years.
Well, then I came here. Let's talk about that for a second. How did you just up and leave Cuba for Guatemala? Were you allowed to go?
Well, no, but the thing is, at that time, I was at the army. My family was living in Guatemala. I said to the government, can I go to Guatemala to see my family? They trust me. They say, yeah, go.
And you never went home?
I never came back, no.
Do you miss Cuba? Are you glad that you're in the U.S.? Where do you fall on this?
Both things. I miss my neighborhood, my food, my people. But at the same time, here in the United States, all your dreams come true easily. The only thing that you have to do is work and have faith.
Work and have faith?
Yes, faith.
In everything you do. Well, and you're here in America at a really interesting time in Cuba. As you watch from Miami what's going on there, power in Cuba has passed to Fidel Castro's brother, Raul. Do you think this means you're going to be able to go back sooner? Do you think not? What? How do you view it?
Well, Cuba is doing well. They are doing a very insignificant change, but they are changed. When I was living in Cuba, there is no possibility to any change.
Let's listen to Manos Pariba.
Manos Pariba.
What does that mean?
Hands in the air.
Hands in the Air. We read that it's a tribute to Earth, Wind, and Fire. Let's listen to a little bit of it first. When did you turn on to Earth, Wind, and Fire?
Well, in my childhood, I was prohibited to listen American music and radio in Cuba. So everybody was looking for the prohibited thing and learn something about the bad guy.
Because
when I hear Wind and Fire, Cool and the Gang, Chaka Khan, oh my God, I want to die. I want to be like him. I need to be like him. That's my dream.
First because it was prohibited, you wanted to hear it, and then because you fell in love with it like young Americans did.
You need to learn about the prohibited thing. Why they are prohibited? Why?
Yeah. Boy, Earth, Wind, and Fire as, you know, something that might endanger someone. It's hard for us to grasp, you know, here in the U.S. I mean, Earth, Wind, and Fire, they were tame, you know, but they were banned. I want to ask you, Jorge, in Cuba, your parents were classical pianists?
Yeah, my father and my mother.
And you have done some work with classical musicians. You've worked with the Minnesota Symphony, and we hear that you have an upcoming project with James Galway, the Irish flutist.
My friend, yeah. It's going to be something like Havana and Ireland, yes.
So it'll be a combination of Havana and Ireland. But I want to touch on the work you did with the Minnesota Orchestra, Rumba Symphonica. We want to hear a little. And ask, what was it like working with the classical orchestra? As we said, you grew up with classical musicians, so this must have been a little like coming home for you.
Exactly, coming home. It's like a feeling that you are younger again.
Younger again. You know, you were talking about leaving Cuba behind. It reminds me of one of your songs, Tengo Que Olvidarte. It talks about forgetting as a way of healing the pain of leaving things behind. Let's listen to that. ¿Cómo voy a olvidar cuando te vi partir? ¿Cómo voy a borrar esa huella de mí? Do you want to go back?
Of course. I want to see my friend. My friend in Cuba is like my family. All day, every day. Playing with them, go to school together, talking about growing together.
Hmm. But instead, as you write in your Rice with Mango song, you carry Cuba around in your head. Yeah. That's Tiempo Libre musical director Jorge Gomez. The band's latest CD is Lo Que Esperabas. Jorge, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Yo no sé por qué, solo me miré hasta para enloquecer. Mi corazón no puede comprender, cómo es posible que ya no logre entender. Ya no sé qué hacer, pienso que el mundo...
And this note, if you're traveling in Miami, you'll soon be able to see Tiempo Libre on stage in a new musical, Miami Libre, which opens in Miami in July. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now. Sin dormir, días enteros viendo cómo descubrir la magia de tenerme como un loco así, tras de su vida sin poder salir. No sé si.